This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of December, and this week the president got laughed out of Europe. Trump was in the UK for the annual NATO summit. He fought openly with French President Emmanuel Macron about policy toward ISIS. And then Macron was caught on camera having an incredulous conversation with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. They were laughing about Trump's rambling press conferences. So Trump canceled his final press conference at the summit and left early to return to Washington. The Biden for President campaign quickly cut the laughter into an ad, though of course the president's defenders say he won in part as a revolt against the sort of global elites seen literally laughing at him. Later in today's show, we will talk with Jonathan Katz from the German Marshall Fund about the aftermath of the summit and the broader effects of Trump's foreign policy as tensions rise with China and on the Korean Peninsula. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Liz, what have you been watching this week?
I'll admit, I didn't expect Kamala Harris, the senator from California and former prosecutor, to drop out of the 2020 Democratic primary race before several other seemingly likelier candidates. But after a Times report dropped on November 29 detailing the chaos inside her campaign, it started to look pretty inevitable. And indeed, Harris is now out of the race. Why? Despite having all the makings of an appealing Dem candidate, she could never quite figure out what she stood for. Even her own campaign aides had no real sense of who she was trying to be in the race. She came out for Medicare for All and then backed off. She went on the offensive against Biden, only to later retreat. It seems voters couldn't quite figure out what to make of her, and with stronger personalities in the running, the mystery apparently wasn't worth solving. I think that is sort of a signal for other candidates still in the race. Warren could probably take note. She has suffered a precipitous drop in the polls after enjoying a nice rise. And part of it seems to have to do with her efforts to modulate her message, to back off of Medicare for All a little bit, and to assure voters that she's not the radical lefty that she seemed to be. But if she's not, then who is she? Answering that question seems like it's going to be pretty important for sticking around in this race.
Rich, one of the comparisons I'd made periodically was that Harris seemed to be the Marco Rubio of this field, like someone who on paper looked like the perfect candidate, but that was maybe a problem that they were trying too hard to be the on paper perfect candidate, and it made it unclear what they were at their core. But maybe that's unfair to Rubio at this point, who did considerably better in the 2016 primaries than Kamala Harris has done here. Maybe she's the Tim Pawlenty of this field.
Yeah, I guess that's a better comparison. I was skeptical at the time of your case that Marco Rubio was the Marco Rubio of the Republican race. You ended up being right about that. But I do think the Rubio-esque aspect of trying to be being something to both sides of the party divide and not really knowing where who she was or why she was in this race was a huge element of her downfall. And there was a certain falsity and insincerity to it, and that's just deadly in any party's primary, anytime, any place.
Liz, I've been seeing a lot of reactions to this, that basically people saying things like, well, I wasn't for Kamala, but I'm really sad to see her out of the race. People saying, you know, I'm not for Julian Castro, but it's really disappointing that he's not getting more attention. And this stuff just seems like really weird and fake to me. Like, if you're not for these candidates, then you're not for these candidates. And in particular, you see a lot of lamentations. You know, it's possible that we're going to have an all-white primary debate stage, depending on whether Cory Booker or Julian Castro is able to get over the hump and qualify for the December debate. But I mean, that's, you know, it sort of feels to me like you have to take that up with the voters, that in particular, you know, this is going to be a 40% non-white electorate, and you're seeing both white voters and non-white voters gravitating toward four candidates who are white, even in a very diverse field at the beginning. So I sort of feel like, you know, voters, you know, it's a diverse voter base. They have an opportunity to choose a diverse candidate, and it seems that the specific set of candidates they're being offered, that's not who they're going for.
Right. I mean, I think that it's a mistake to assume that in a diverse field, non-white voters or white voters are going to make their decision about who to support strictly based on the identity characteristics of the candidate. I think that a lot of Democratic strategists and election watchers probably took away the wrong lessons from Obama's vast appeal, that he appealed to non-white voters, that he appealed to young voters. I don't think that was strictly because he was a person of color himself. It's not just because Obama was black that he had that appeal. He had quite a bit going for him in terms of an inspiring campaign message and a primary opponent in Hillary Clinton. As we can see, that helped Bernie as well. If you compare his number numbers now from his numbers last time around. But what voters appear to be concerned about has more to do with this rift in the Democratic Party between the progressive, liberal, left wing, whatever you want to call it, and the moderate, modulating wing that's kind of trying to preserve a center consensus. I think that's really where voters are splitting up, and I think it's where they're being energized. And so the identitarian concerns are just sort of falling into a lower priority category.
I'm not sure I agree with that. And the reason for that is that, you know, I think as you mentioned Elizabeth Warren's drop in the polls, it looks especially in Iowa like a lot of that is about her, people who were saying they were going to support her now becoming more inclined to say that they're going to support Mayor Pete Buttigieg, which suggests to me that a lot of voters aren't looking at this primary through the ideological lens of moderates versus versus leftist candidates that I think you see in the media. And it also, I think, accurately does describe the ideological differences among the candidates. I find it surprising then how many voters seem to be open to supporting a candidate on either side of that divide and even are changing their minds between candidates who are on either side of that divide.
Yeah, I mean, you have this weird phenomenon now this week where I would have thought, and I think I've said in the show, that the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders truce is bound to fail at some point because they seem to be fishing from the same pool of voters. But you have Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg now sniping at each other because they're pulling from the same pool of demographic voters in Iowa, college-educated whites. So it does suggest this is more scrambled and complex than the easy kind of quote-unquote lane discourse all of us fall into.
Sure. And I do think it's always going to be more complicated than that. I think part of what's going on with Warren and Buttigieg is that it's likely that for voters, the progressive or radical or change-oriented wing of the party and then the moderate or status quo wing of the party, the division between them is less ideological. So voters are probably trying to, in my view at least, distinguish between those two things. But the way they're distinguishing between them is not necessarily based on like the layout of programs and more based on the rhetoric and the self-presentation. So Buttigieg is young. He's exciting in that he's different. And he talks about, being a candidate who's going to be different and something new and bringing something sort of millennial to the table, even though if you look at his policies, they're among the more moderate in the field. So I assume that's why he's picking off from Warren.
Although it's, of course, the person who's in the lead remains the person who's been in the lead all along, who is Joe Biden. And I know, Rich, you were watching Joe Biden this
week.
Yeah,
so I think Joe Biden perhaps had something unprecedented in his entire campaign, a good week. You mentioned this ad, this anti-Trump ad, based on the NATO meeting and the other leaders gossiping about him. He got John Kerry's endorsement. Endorsements aren't the most important thing, but they are telling. And then he had this exchange in Iowa with a voter who was confronting him about Hunter Biden's alleged corruption and Ukraine. And Biden responded in sort of a ridiculous way. let's have a push-up contest, man. You know what you're talking about, Jack. And caught himself. He's about to call him a fatso or say something about it. He was like, look fat. And they caught himself. But I think, one, this sort of thing, you just can't judge it the way you would have in the pre-Trump era. Two, I think it goes to how a certain segment of voters think he'll stand up well to Trump because he has this fight and moxie. And so my percentage odds of him winning the nomination haven't been that high, but I've upped them lately, in part because of his persistence in national polls in Nevada and South Carolina, but also in part he has more, I think, paths. If he wins Iowa, which could still happen, is still scrambled there, he's a nominee, very likely. He could lose Iowa and still has ways to make it happen. So I'm reluctantly coming around to he is in a stronger position than I've thought for a long time, although I'm still skeptical whether it's going to happen for him.
I wasn't sure what to make of this exchange with the voter. I mean, I watched it and like kind of liked it. Like it's good to see him being energetic. The president keeps referring to him as sleepy Joe Biden. I think it's good to see someone who has fight in him. It actually reminded me of Chris Christie, the way that back when this worked for Chris Christie, right, during his campaigns for governor, he'd pick these fights and people in the media media and people on the left would complain about it, but I think it really showed resolve and people liked it until they decided they didn't like it. And so I thought it was mostly good. Simone Sanders, his spokesperson, claims that he wasn't about to call the voter fat, that he was going to say, look, facts, which maybe, probably not, especially coming right off, you know, his saying that, you know, he, unlike this voter, has stamina and, you know, can run laps around him and, you know, let's have a push-up contest. But the thing that still makes me nervous, and maybe this is more a nervousness about the general election than the primary, is the extent to which the Hunter Biden thing is a real weakness for him. And he's basically, you know, the voter had accused him of setting up Hunter Biden with this job, which I think is not what happened. But Biden also says nobody's accused my son of doing anything wrong, which is not true. People definitely have. And I think it's true that his son did do something unethical. I don't think there's a strong case that his son committed a crime. But I think it's strange how he sort of won't give any ground on the idea that, you know, his son shouldn't have done this, even when Hunter Biden himself has said that he regrets what he's done here. And so the sort of just pushing back and saying nothing to see here, I'm not sure how tenable that is in the long run. Liz?
Yeah, I don't think it will be tenable in the long run. I think it's probably one of the reasons that you see Biden showing up in some polls as pretty weak against Trump. And the fact that Biden doesn't appear prepared to take it seriously or respond to it in a serious way is disturbing. I do think Rich is right. I think Biden has a path to the nomination. And I think that is also really disturbing, you know, not least because of the Hunter Biden thing, but because of his kind of questionable mental state. He collapses periodically in public events into, I guess, what you might call reverie. He related this kind of Cheever anecdote about his blonde leg hair swaying in a swimming pool while children touched it. And I mean, that is a perfectly fine memory to have and like kind of an oddly beautiful piece of Americana. But definitely
Biden's leg hair deserves to be in the American Museum of Natural History.
definitely not something that you would think that a candidate in his position with his sort of record of saying off color and weird things and having sort of strange relations with people around him would relate. And I'm not sure he recognizes that. Maybe it's that politics have changed and Biden has not. But there are a lot of things that make me think he would be an easy, easy target for Trump.
I don't know. I think the Hunter thing is a real liability. The like Biden being weird stuff, I think, is at the very least priced in. And also, I don't think related to him being, you know, losing a step. I mean, in fact, when he challenged the voter to an IQ test, that caused people to get out the file footage from his 1987 run for president when he challenged a voter to an IQ test and also like falsely claimed to have been near the top of his law school class and things like that. So some of this is how Biden has always been. So on the one hand, like everyone knows that. And if it was going to take him out, I think it would have done so by now. On the other hand, Biden ran for president twice before, and it did not end so well. So
I think the other notable thing that's happened in the Democratic race is Bernie has much more of a pulse now. He's tied or ahead of Elizabeth Warren in a lot of polls. There's a California poll that had him ahead, and he very easily could win Iowa as well and would be strong in New Hampshire too. So it's a really fluid race.
My skepticism about that goes back to what Liz mentioned earlier about Bernie Sanders having been fortunate to be running against Hillary Clinton back in 2016. The committed core of like people who are for Bernie Sanders because they are socialists is smaller than people thought it was. And I think we're mostly seeing that show up as his resiliency in the polls. I think part of Elizabeth Warren's weakness is that the people who are voter base were less ideologically left than a lot of people thought, which made it a lot more possible for candidates to sort of steal from her to the right. And most of those committed socialist voters are still with Bernie. I think a lot of the other people who were for Bernie, either because they wanted an outsider or because they just really didn't like Hillary, will really prefer some of the other candidates in this field in a way that I think would make it hard for him to consolidate the majority he would need to get to the nomination. What I was watching this week was the jobs report. And it was a strong one, 266,000 jobs created in November. That number was boosted by the fact that there was a GM strike that ended, so a lot of those workers have gotten back on the job. But we also saw revisions of the October and September numbers. When you add this all up, it looks like job growth is as strong this year as it was in 2017, about the same as it was in 2016. And so there had been a sense about a year ago that the economy was flashing a bunch of warning signs, that a serious slowdown was looking likely, exacerbated by the president's trade war, by slowdowns in China and Europe, maybe by the Fed raising interest rates more than it should. That picture looks so different than it did a year ago. The economy remains quite good, if not as great as it could be, and I think likely to remain quite good through the election. And even wage growth, which could be faster, it's at 3.1%, and it's at the best at the low end of the spectrum. Low-paying industries have been seeing wages rising at 4% a year. So I think that helps explain why when you look at the polling, you see satisfaction with the economy that goes beyond just people who own stocks and have been enjoying the run-up in the stock market. And it seems to me that this is likely to be a significant asset to the president as he seeks re-election in a year. Liz, does the president deserve some credit for that, or at least even if liberals don't want to give the president credit for that, should they be sort of recognizing that the economy is better than I think you would see from some of the electorate from Democratic candidates, and they need to find ways to talk to voters who do feel good about the economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that your latter point is true. I mean, one thing that I notice about how voters respond to conditions on the ground is that when a member of the party they don't like is in power, they don't think conditions are good. And when a member of the party they do like is in power, they do think conditions are good. So there's quite a bit of a warping that goes on in terms of how people perceive what's happening around them. But I do think it's worth dealing with the fact that we're doing all right for now. I think that one thing that Democrats could emphasize is the precarity of this condition, right? We're watching every month to see what happens. We've already had a scare about a recession this year. And some economists are still forecasting another major recession. Coming off of the financial crisis of 2008, Americans who are voting now can still remember very clearly what that was like. And Democrats should be emphasizing the fact that we need measures that are going to prevent this kind of boom and bust instability that's very, very damaging, destroys a lot of wealth and really hurts people. And also bracing ourselves for these inevitable bumps with programs that are going to take care of people even when the economy fails.
Rich, what do you make of that?
Well, one, just in sheer political terms on the economic conditions, if you just look at the economic conditions, you say he's a cinch to get reelected. Then you look at his poll numbers and you say there's absolutely no way he's going to get reelected. And it's obviously somewhere in between. We haven't experienced a kind of a boom and a bust in a while now. We've sort of had a steady increase in economic well-being. It took a long time to really take off in the Obama years. It got better towards the end, although actually it was falling off a little bit in 2016. And Trump has a good record to brag about. And however you litigate what differences policies have made, just as a practical matter, presidents, you know, in their first terms, get to take credit or get blamed for whatever the broad economic conditions are.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about impeachment. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist of The Washington Post. Now I want to talk about impeachment. The impeachment process has moved from the House Intelligence Committee to the Judiciary Committee. In Judiciary, there was a hearing on Wednesday with law professors making the case for or against impeachment. And on Thursday, Nancy Pelosi formally asked the committees to bring her articles of impeachment against the president. To talk about the law professors' phase of the impeachment process, we're joined now by Jonathan Adler. Jonathan is a law professor at Case Western Reserve University. Hello, Jonathan.
Good to be here.
So unlike a lot of the hearings that we had in the Intelligence Committee, I didn't feel like we learned very much at this Judiciary Committee hearing with the law professors. Did we need the law professors here?
I don't know if we needed them, but I do think when Congress is considering something as weighty and serious as impeaching and potentially removing a president, having some discussion about the relevant constitutional provisions, what they mean, what their purpose is, and whether or not using those provisions is consistent with the constitutional oath that members of Congress takes is a good idea. In fact, I would argue that this sort of constitutional discussion should actually take place more often in Congress, not less.
So do you think we had a productive one? Did we learn much about that? I know ahead of the hearing, one of your criticisms had been, you know, there was one, the Republicans called Jonathan Turley to testify against impeachment, essentially. The Democrats had three witnesses, all of whom were liberals. And you were saying basically, you know, there's a lot of conservative and libertarian legal thinkers who also think impeachment is warranted here. You could make a stronger case that this doesn't break down or at least shouldn't break down along ideological lines if you called someone who was a little more out of the box for committee Democrats, but they didn't do that.
Right. I think there are two issues. One, if the committee is actually genuinely interested in understanding what the range of academic opinion is on these questions, then they should invite a range of experts. And if one remembers back in the Clinton impeachment, the equivalent hearing featured far more witnesses, not just law professors, but historians as well, both experts called by each side as well as some that the two sides agreed on together. So if that's the purpose of the hearing, then I think you don't just want to kind of call in the usual suspects. Now, I also think that in the context of something like impeachment, you know, there is a risk that these sorts, as we've seen, that these sorts of inquiries devolve into political tribalism. And I think having a hearing where the various witnesses can be characterized primarily in terms of their tribal or partisan affiliations doesn't further the inquiry, and I'm not sure it adds very much. And I think a broader cross-section of academic experts could have helped push against that and could have helped show that even people who, like many of Donald Trump's policies, who tend to support Republicans, who consider themselves particularly conservative or unwoke, could still conclude that the sorts of conduct that has been alleged constitutes a high crime or misdemeanor as understood by the Constitution's framers.
Rich, this hearing led to the dumbest news cycle of the week, which is to say that Pamela Karlan, one of the law professors there, made an analogy about the clause of the Constitution about accepting titles of nobility. She said, you can name your son Baron, but you can't make him a baron. And then, you know, Melania Trump criticized the law professor for attacking her child, which I don't really think that was an attack on Baron Trump, although it was, you know, it ended up serving as the distraction, the thing that people remember out of this hearing rather than any of the actual constitutional analysis around impeachment.
Yeah, so clearly I think she was overly fond of this wordplay over concerns about good taste. You know, not that it was a vicious attack on Trump and Melania's son, but I think Jonathan makes a really shrewd point. It's just it was just like shooting fish in the barrel for Republicans to say, well, to these three progressive law professors, well, you've always wanted to impeach Trump. You gave money to this Democrat and this other Democrat. And if you had someone like Jonathan or someone on the right who favors impeachment, it would have mixed it up and blunted that sort of attack.
Liz, what did you make of the hearing?
I mean, I think the fact that there isn't a super clear narrative emerging from the hearings that appears to be pulling anyone from either side over is a signal that it is, in fact, already devolving into, and in fact was perhaps never much more than sort of partisan tribalism. I think there was a sense that these impeachment hearings were going to be a real ringer and really destroy Trump. And you have seen some movement in the polls about feelings that Trump should in fact be impeached or shouldn't be impeached. I think the feelings are trending toward that he should be, but in a kind of modest way that isn't super pronounced. And so I really don't think they're going as hot as the Democrats might have hoped.
I would say there was movement in the polls when the Ukraine story first broke. The polls have been pretty static on impeachment for the last 2 months. So I think, you know, to your point, I don't think that the hearings, even the hearings in the Intelligence Committee, where I actually think we learned a lot about the president's conduct, they don't seem to have moved public opinion. But the flip side is that public opinion hasn't really rebounded either. There had been a few polls that came out that had some Republicans saying, you know, see, support for impeachment is softening, but the 538 has a tracker that weights the polls and that basically looks like a flat line for 2 months. And so, Rich, I feel like there have been some of these news reports about how top White House advisors at least as of a couple of weeks ago, think Democrats may not go through with impeachment after all, that they were going to get cold feet, which I think was crazy to think. But it sounds like this is an idea that Jared Kushner and some other people have put in the president's head. And I think there are some signs that the White House genuinely believes this. There have been certain political moves they've made that seem aimed at talking Democrats out of going through with impeachment. You had Brad Parscale, who's the campaign manager for the president, tweeting out a poll about in Kendra Horn's district. She's a Democrat who represents Oklahoma City. And that poll showed that impeachment was down 7 points in her district, 45 to 52 against impeaching the president. But that's a district that the president won by 14 points. Kendra Horn is one of the very most vulnerable Democratic incumbents in the House. So if her district has impeachment only down 7, I think that has to make Democrats feel pretty good about proceeding with impeachment. And I don't know how the White House can possibly look at this and think they have any chance of stopping that.
Yeah, they're definitely impeaching him. I think the whole ball game are there 1, 2, 3, maybe upper bounds, 5 House Democrats you could pull off who voted for the inquiry. There are 2 who didn't vote for the inquiry at the beginning, but voted for the inquiry who wouldn't vote for articles of impeachment. And if you just got any erosion there, I think it would be a symbolic problem for the Democrats. But I'm not sure whether they're even going to do that. But the irony here is this is probably the most deft legislative and political campaign the White House has ever run. If you subtract the tweets, which have often been idiotic, they have been blanketing these Trump districts with anti-impeachment ads, which have at least gotten the attention of moderate Democrats and made them uncomfortable. And they've been really working the relationships with Republicans on Capitol Hill.
Jonathan, can you talk a little bit about what we should expect in the Senate? I think as part of this campaign to talk the House out of impeaching, you've been seeing ideas floated like, well, when it gets to the Senate trial, we're going to call Joe Biden to testify. We're going to call Hunter Biden. We're going to look into, Ukrainian efforts in the 2016 election and that sort of thing. Should we expect those things to happen in the Senate? What will govern how that process actually looks, how long this trial will be, and who actually gets called to testify at it?
Well, I mean, ultimately, that's the decision that the Senate majority gets to make. As I think listeners know, the Chief Justice presides over the impeachment trial in the Senate, and the Chief Justice, as an initial matter, will be able to make rulings about the relevance of witnesses, just like a judge in a regular trial would. And under normal standards, Hunter Biden, the whistleblower, and so on, would not be relevant witnesses. They are not probative of the claims about the president's conduct. But under the Senate rules, a majority of the Senate can overrule the presiding officer. And so long as Mitch McConnell can hold his majority together, they could insist upon hearing whomever they like. And that's ultimately how those sorts of decisions are made in the Senate.
So, Liz, if it goes in that direction of a fairly long trial with a lot of politically explosive witnesses, and the president seems to change his mind by the day about whether he wants a long trial or a short one, and to Jonathan's point, since the Republican majority is in charge, the president probably will have a weird degree of control over the circumstances of his own trial. But is that something that Democrats should welcome or be worried about if you're going to have a sort of chaotic thing with lots of high profile witnesses testifying, presumably right around when Democrats are having their first nominating contests?
Yeah, I don't think Democrats themselves know how they feel about that prospect right now. But I do think that if it's going to happen, Democrats should just go ahead and welcome it. And I think what they should emphasize is that the kind of air of weird corruption, lawlessness, like you said, Trump controlling the circumstances of his own trial, all the while accusing everyone else of various misdeeds, and then the circus atmosphere, the ridiculousness and the clownishness of it that we touched on a little bit in terms of Trump's general affect and demeanor at the beginning of the show, with various European and Canadian leaders laughing at him openly, that should be a detriment to Trump. People are sure to tire of this at some point. We can't have a sort of ridiculous carnival atmosphere at the highest levels of government forever, one would assume. And so I think they should just go ahead and emphasize that all of this lawlessness, this carnival stuff, this circus is due to Trump being what Trump is. And if you don't want it anymore and you want to return to a sense of a sort of sober and normal government, then you have to vote him out.
I'm actually very skeptical of the idea that we're going to end up with a long circus trial. And the reason is this. The president is clearly very nervous about the prospect of the Senate trial, probably more nervous than he reasonably ought to be. The party is in line behind him, but the president is conspiratorial and constantly nervous about people stabbing him in the back, and this is no exception. I think we saw that actually in this strange fight that he had with the governor of Georgia over who would be appointed to a Senate seat that's being vacated by Johnny Isaacson, who is resigning for health reasons. The president really wanted his ally from the House, Doug Collins, appointed to that Senate seat. And the news report said part of the reason for that was that the president was really sure that Doug Collins would be a no vote on removing him from office. Now, the crazy thing about that is Kelly Loeffler, who's actually getting appointed, this businesswoman, also is a sure no vote on removing him from office. But it's clear that the president takes seriously the idea that his fate is in the hands of the Senate. And so when it gets to the Senate, why would the president want to prolong the process for weeks in a chaotic manner that could bring new information to light, could change public opinion about the impeachment? I think he's just going to want it over as soon as possible because he wants a verdict that he's not removed so he can move on.
Yeah, I was talking to a Republican senator about this, and he says they want to coordinate with Trump, and they're sort of waiting to see what he wants. And he, of course, is been going back and forth between both extremes. Either dismiss it right out of the gate, or do this long trial where you're getting to the bottom of the alleged Ukrainian meddling in our election and all the rest of it. But I just think McConnell's going to want a real but expeditious trial. And when it comes to witnesses, it's just hard to see who the good Republican witnesses would be and why they'd want a parade of them. You know, it's hard to think of one. You know, how are they going to get dozens, you know, to hold up this process for months? So, you know, my guess is it's over within 3 weeks and maybe quicker than that.
Yeah, I was going to say, one thing also we want to keep in mind is that I think as we get closer to the Senate trial, some Republicans will think about, do they want to put either themselves or the Chief Justice in the position of having the Chief Justice to rule on motions that are not favorable to them. And I think that will also affect their consideration, because if they lose three members of their caucus on some sort of procedural question, a question about whether or not a particular witness's testimony would be relevant or not, then they would lose control of that question. So I'm not sure that a lot of Republican senators want to be in the position of having to deal with taking those sorts of votes and that sort of conflict with the Chief Justice.
What about this idea of simply dismissing the charges once it gets to the Senate, not having a trial, just saying, you know, like this, you know, this impeachment was wrongfully brought and we're just throwing the thing out? Can the Senate do that, Jonathan? I mean, I suspect that Republicans would prefer not to do it, in part because they would rather be attacked over keeping the president in office instead of being attacked over refusing to even hear the evidence about the president before deciding to keep him in office. I think it's cleaner for Republican senators to acquit than to dismiss. But they could dismiss if they feel like it?
They could, yes. So a motion to dismiss would be in order. And again, a simple majority would do that. I'm not sure that every member of the Republican caucus would vote to dismiss right off the bat. You know, I leave to you guys the politics of it. But I certainly think that, you know, there is a reasonable prudential argument about whether or not the specific offenses justify removing a president. There is a debate about whether or not something like that should occur in an election year. There are arguments there. I think the arguments that the Senate should not even hear the evidence and should not even consider what the House has put forward is a much harder argument to make.
Liz, we've talked a lot on this show about the relative merits of a quick impeachment process versus an extended one. We got this report from Adam Schiff and from the majority Democrats on the Intelligence Committee laying out the case for the president's wrongdoing. And Schiff explicitly pushed back on what we've heard from you and a lot of others about, you know, why they should take more time to look around and gather more evidence. And he basically says, not only do we know enough about the bad things the president did, but time is of the essence because we're coming up on another election, which he could also try to seek further foreign interference in. I was wondering what you make of that argument as an argument for, like, why now?
Yeah, I mean, that's reasonable. I think generally when people talk about coming up upon the next election, they're not emphasizing that Trump could again seek foreign interference, but dealing with the fact that Democrats have sort of a limited amount of capital to spend with voters and they need to focus on getting Democrats elected rather than trying to ouster Trump, which could go either way. You know, so I think that it makes some sense. Of course, you know, time only became of the essence pretty recently. I still think that a more protracted inquiry could be of use. You know, I maintain that Democrats have accused Trump of so much that actually putting some evidence, you know, at least harder to dispute in the public field could be useful. But I understand Schiff's concerns, and I do think that it's right for Democrats to focus, you know, on electing a Democrat at this point.
Let's leave it there. Jonathan Adler teaches at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Bruning of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine, who tweeted about an interview where Elizabeth Warren bragged about a few years ago how she opposed the expansion of the very successful charter school sector in Boston, Massachusetts. And Chait tweeted, "Warren opposed reform to improve schools for low-income parents, tells parents to fix the schools themselves."
Liz Brunig, what's your tweet of the week?
Earlier this week, a user who goes by Yana on Twitter said, "I just want to say a lot of y'all dump information on your friends at the wrong time without their consent. If you know it's something that could hurt them, ask permission before you decide to be messy, please." She posted a screen cap where she was saying to a friend, "Are you in the right headspace to receive information that could possibly hurt you?" I so wish the news would ask me that as well.
My tweet of the week comes from Ested Herndon, politics reporter at the New York Times. He tweets, "The Twitter isn't real life crowd is correct about the underrepresented moderate Democratic electorate, but it's often wrong on who that is. The most important and missing moderate on here is the more church-going black grandma driven by pragmatism than the never-Trumper driven by anti-left ideology." This is right, and if you missed our Thanksgiving episode, I had an interesting extended conversation with Ested and Charlotte Alter from Time Magazine about what you see on the campaign trail from voters that's driving some of the trends in who's leading the polls. I would note that Ested's observation is why Joe Biden is leading this race, not Mike Bloomberg. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Jonathan Katz from the German Marshall Fund to talk about President Trump's Euro trip. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at The Washington Post. After President Trump cut short his time at the NATO summit, The Washington Post published what they called a field guide to Trump's foreign trips. Here's what Ashley Parker, Philip Rucker, and Michael Birnbaum had to say. Quote, "President Trump often ends his foreign jaunts with a grand flourish, a solo news conference where he plays the flamboyant diplomat, riffing on the trip, establishing dominance, and most important, offering his final version of reality before blowing out of town. That Trump slunk out of the NATO summit here Wednesday after hastily canceling his planned news conference underscored just how unsettling he found his two-day visit," unquote. Jonathan Katz joins us to talk about that summit in Britain. He's a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund. During the Obama administration, Jonathan worked at the U.S. Agency for International Development and at the State Department. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So when I see things like this and the president creating these sorts of news stories at these international summits, I'm always wondering, you know, what the opportunity costs are. Are there things that should have been achieved at this NATO summit that weren't because the president was distracting and combative and weird? Or, you know, I mean, what the president's supporters would say is that he's actually had a fair amount of success convincing NATO members to spend more on their own defense. So maybe this stuff is working, or at least maybe it's not causing problems.
Well, it certainly may have been helpful that the president slunk away before the NATO summit declaration. Every NATO summit, that there's this declaration that sort of outlines all the key objectives reached. The president left town. The summit declaration is sort of laid out with the president not there. In the past, the president has actually pulled his signature away from this important summit declaration. So in a sense, the president leaving early actually enabled the people who are doing the work on the ground, NATO officials, U.S. and other officials that are actually doing the hard work of addressing the deep challenges facing the transatlantic alliance, to get to do their job. And so in a sense, it was a good thing, and remove the distraction and actually let the big boys and girls at the table handle the issues at hand. And I think that's what happened.
Liz, is that reassuring or is that unnerving if sort of the foreign policy apparatus can go on running U.S. international relations in the absence of the commander-in-chief?
I mean, I think it suggests that there's quite a bit more about the United States that's similar to like a failed state than we might like to think, that there are these large parts of the bureaucracy and different agencies that are more or less separate from the American people and any kind of mandate coming from them, and also from the executive or any other kind of elected official. They just sort of operate autonomously and do as they wish. I think we've known that for a while. You know, it's sort of comforting in the sense that their interests appear to not include everything descending into chaos. But it's disturbing in that their interests don't also seem to align very frequently with what the American people actually want. So a little bit of both.
Rich, this summit comes at a time when I think there's sort of an increasing level of chaos in the president's own foreign policy. He hasn't delivered the trade agreement with China that he had announced triumphantly that there was going to be this phase one deal that, you know, now he's saying we may not have a trade deal until after the election. His, you know, bluster about NAFTA led to some pretty minor revisions that he hasn't so far even been able to get through Congress. North Korea is sounding hostile again. South Korea has been getting a little bit closer to China, I think because they're nervous about the level of U.S. support for South Korea that's been traditional. And in Europe, I don't think the president has really capitalized on the opportunity that Brexit could have presented. You could have seen that as an opportunity for a deepening U.S.-UK relationship. The president has made some noises about a trade deal, but mostly he's caused trouble, like going over to Britain in the summer and saying that as part of a trade deal, he would want them to privatize part of the National Health Service, which is an idea that people hate in Britain. So this feels to me like it's exactly the sort of abdication of American leadership that Republicans used to say Barack Obama was engaging in.
Yeah, well, he's had trouble following through on pretty much anything, and the impulse to kind of tariff anyone, including allies, is a really unhealthy one. With NATO in particular, though, I think what was notable of the last week is sort of this reversal of position of Macron and Trump, where Macron, you know, says NATO's brain dead, and Trump, just in reflexive opposition to Macron, like, how can you talk about our treasured alliance this way? And then also, more meaningfully, it's Macron who now seems most desperate to extend a hand to Russia in a way that's most alarming to NATO's easternmost members. So that's a problem. And also, you know, people talk about Trump and American first and wanting to go his own way. Macron has this French impulse that's not favorable to NATO and doesn't like being caught up on it, and this persistent fantasy that there'll somehow be some vast EU defense effort when the British are going to probably be out of the EU and the Germans have no interest in spending on defense for anything, whether it's NATO or whether it be some new EU initiative. So I think we see how Macron's vision has actually been more threatening to NATO than Trump's.
Jonathan, what do you make of that relationship between Macron and the president? I mean, because it feels like it's gone through so many phases. There was like the Trump-Macron bromance phase. There was a period where it seemed like Macron was really trying to butter up the president and sort of, you know, sway him toward more, you know, French and European interests. And now you see Macron like really openly having a fight with the president about ISIS in front of everyone at this NATO summit. It seems like and when you combine that with the sort of the laughing behind his back, am I right to look at this and see that, you know, world leaders, or at least the leaders of these democratic countries, no longer find it worthwhile to try to make the president feel favorably toward them, and that they don't perceive a big cost to being perceived as in opposition to him?
Yeah, I think, first of all, there's been a breakup, a Macron-Trump breakup. You know, really, the relationship was really never solidified anyways. What Macron is reacting to, what European leaders are reacting to, is the erratic foreign policy of the administration, a president that has said NATO is obsolete, that it's not obsolete, a president that has threatened to remove the United States from NATO. And so if you're a European leader, if you're Macron, if you're Angela Merkel, or any of these leaders, when you're looking at the United States, you're wondering, will the U.S. be there? Will they fulfill Article 5 commitments that is part of all NATO members' responsibilities?
Article 5 is the provision of the NATO treaty that requires members to come to each other's military defense.
That's correct. And so you have that situation building up. In addition, the president's decision, sort of late at night in a phone call with President Erdogan, to remove U.S. troops, you know, in northern Syria without consulting with allies who have been with the United States fighting ISIS, And because Europe is has deep concerns about those fighters coming back into Europe, let's not forget the French terrorist attacks that took place and others across Europe. There's a real concern. Can you trust the United States? And it's pretty clear by what took place when you see those leaders in the background talking about Trump that there's a lack of trust in him. And how could any ally or partner trust the president of the United States when at a moment's notice via a tweet or a late night call with another leader actually make a decision that has ramifications not only for U.S. national security, but for the security of our allies? And I think that's what's at stake right now. And I think a big question for Macron and others is if President Trump has a second go around as president next year, will he pull the U.S. outside of NATO?
You mentioned the president's phone call with the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. There was also a policide or a meeting one-on-one between the two of them at this summit that I think caught people by some surprise. Do we have any sense of what they discussed there and whether there are any developments in that U.S.-Turkey relationship?
I still think that there's an ongoing engagement on northern Syria. U.S. troops still remain in some sense there. There's still engagement between the United States and Kurdish officials there that I believe that Turkey still considers to be terrorist organizations, that they're concerned about Turkey from their security needs. And I think the fact that the U.S., despite the president saying one thing, the U.S. still remains engaged. And I think from the Turkish side, there's still concerns. So they're talking that over, concerns about the S-400, I hope are on the table. S-400s are a Russian missile defense system that Turkey has purchased, even though they're a NATO ally. NATO members, including the United States, have deep concerns about this missile defense system and how it may affect the F-35. But it's also concerns about a NATO member state growing much closer to Vladimir Putin. And Congress has weighed in with both legislation for sanctions, but also resolutions and concerns about the direction that Turkey is taking. NATO has a number of autocratic rulers inside NATO right now that have grown closer to Mr. Putin, and there's just this growing concern. I doubt that President Trump was raising these issues with President Erdogan. I hope he was. But I think the bigger concern for President Erdogan and President Trump in the conversation is what's taking place in northern Syria.
Liz, it's remarkable to me the way these issues are being discussed in the Democratic primary, which is to say, you know, the level of support among Democrats for NATO and other international military institutions, the reverence with which Democrats are discussing intelligence agencies and sort of how dare you, you know, discount the assessments of the CIA and such. And there are good reasons that I think there are some good reasons that those shifts have happened. And, you know, the CIA is right about a lot of things and the president is ignoring true things that he's hearing from the intelligence community. But, you know, typically there is a certain amount of suspicion on the left about these agencies and about the sort of the blob policies that you get from the permanent foreign policy and security apparatus. And Tulsi Gabbard obviously talks a lot about this. Liberals have a lot of reasons not to care for Tulsi Gabbard. Bernie Sanders, I guess that this is part of his message, but it doesn't feel like we're really having the debate where, you know, some people on the left might want to say, hey, wait a minute, do we really want to become the party of this, you know, of this international establishment?
Yeah, I think it's been a sort of funny experiment from the beginning in terms of how the left has responded to Trump. That has triggered, I think, a pretty unprecedented, at least in the past few decades, amount of open liberal admiration for these security agencies, the CIA, the FBI, that are openly and notoriously hostile to the left. But because members of these agencies have been involved in saying that Trump is unqualified or that Trump is dangerous, liberals have openly cozied up to them. I think that is really silly. I think it's a bargain where you don't get anything in return. I don't think it's going to reduce the CIA or the FBI's hostility to sort of left policy goals or left political activity in America. And so I do think it's worth asking why there hasn't been more of a pushback. You know, my suspicion is that for a lot of liberals, the biggest problem with Trump is that he makes everything feel abnormal. is that he violates norms and he's a sort of bizarre president and he invites a lot of precarity and a lot of anxiety, especially around issues and features of American life that liberals care a lot about. And they feel like this international establishment that has been, you know, controlling or at least heavily influencing American domestic and international policy for the past few decades is what's been keeping it normal, what's been keeping things predictable and regular. And so they see that as an alternative to Trump. And so they feel like if they have to choose, they're going to choose that establishment. I think it's a false dichotomy, but I still think that's where they are.
A lot of Republicans, Rich, seem weirdly zen about that precarity, including Republicans who, you know, you would have said a few years ago that their key animating issue was foreign policy and security, people like Lindsey Graham. Why is that? Is it that they didn't care that much about the positions they held before? Is it that they are convinced that they've gotten President Trump in a box where they've, you know, prevented his worst instincts? Why, you know, it's almost a cliche at this point, but like imagine if Obama did these things, the way these people would react. They're not having that reaction.
So part of it is a legitimate reaction to the widespread sense, even within the Republican Party, that the two big wars did not end well and turn out well. They haven't ended, at least Afghanistan certainly has, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Lindsey's a different case because he's playing this game with Trump where he wants to have influence, and the way to have influence is really picking your shots really carefully about when you're going to criticize him in public. But Liz was just saying, and the question you're asking of her, I would tend to think, maybe I'm too fatalistic, I just tend to think everyone's going to kind of post-Trump, whenever that happens, will snap back a little bit. And I think the natural tendency of the Democratic Party, deep-seated impulse, is to try to get along with our adversaries and not inflame them, you know, which is why we had the reset, you know, during the Obama administration, et cetera. So I got to think that snaps back. And I think some element of the Republican hawkishness snaps back in reaction to that if there's a Democratic president, except for there is, and we'll see how big and influential it really is if we get in a post-Trump environment in a year or two. There is a populist right that is different on foreign policy and really skeptical of these international organizations and intervention of any sort. So that is a tendency on the right that's much more pronounced than it was before, although, again, I don't think we've seen a true test of its influence yet.
Jonathan, if the next president has a more typical orientation toward NATO for a U.S. president, will there be lasting effects on the alliance from the Trump administration and the approach that he will have taken in his term? Or will we be able to basically go back to the status quo ante like it was in 2016?
I thought what Rich said too was really interesting on sort of this populist wing within the Republican Party that I think is having an outsized influence on foreign policy decision making in this White House, and whether you'll see Republicans sort of as maybe sort of swing back. But of course, you know, anytime you have a leader of the United States who's got a strong following, popular following in the Republican Party, where he's saying NATO is obsolete, we should withdraw from NATO. Even if he's not there, these arguments that have been made remain in that public space. And because of, and I think it's a fair question to ask too, because Iraq and Afghanistan are issues that have not been resolved, there is a reluctance across the American public for military engagement. And so NATO is a military alliance. But I do think the point, just on the last sort of thread here too, you know, people are concerned, and when we talk about democratic foreign policy, and the reason why there's this connectedness to, you know, looking at the intelligence community for answers is really has a lot to do with Russia and the 2016 election, where you had intelligence agencies, all of them before the election, say that Russia is interfering. And so I think from that point on, there's been this reliance that the intelligence community is the watchdog when you have malign influence, like from Russia. And including the upcoming election, where you have intelligence agencies saying Russia is going to interfere along with others. And this is the intelligence agencies of this administration saying this happening. So when you see the president of the United States sort of dismissing these concerns, but the U.S. intelligence agencies continue to talk about it, of course, Democrats and others are going to point to the, you know, to the intelligence agencies as the ones who are providing light and truth to these issues. And so I think that's where you see the relationship. But if you look at the 2000s, that wasn't the case, especially with the issues of torture, where these intelligence agencies and others were really being battered by Democrats and others concerned about their conduct and their role, both in particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Jonathan Katz is senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund. Thank you very much for joining us, Jonathan.
Thank you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunick, what's your rant?
So now that Elizabeth Warren is dipping in the polls and Pete Buttigieg is surging ahead of her, there's quite a bit of back and forth between their campaigns about their respective records. One of the annoying things about what's coming out of the Buttigieg campaign is it suggests that Warren's history as an attorney, sometimes doing corporate law, and formerly being a Republican, suggests that she's not as progressive as she seems. I feel like that's really disingenuous. Elizabeth Warren is about as progressive as she seems, which is not as progressive as Bernie Sanders, but still a lot more progressive than Pete Buttigieg. So that attack line coming out of Buttigieg's campaign is incredibly dishonest, disingenuous, unfair, and really irritating.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I'd also like to rant about Pete Buttigieg, who has been the subject in recent weeks of a series of woke attacks. The latest and most ridiculous, that he was a Salvation Army bell ringer in 2017, which has been deemed unacceptable because the Salvation Army is allegedly homophobic. This is a smear of the Salvation Army, or at least highly reductive about an organization that does an immense amount of good. Mayor Pete should be completely unabashed about his scandalous bell ringing.
My rant is about the calendar. If you feel really rushed this holiday season, there's a reason for that. Thanksgiving fell as late as possible. It means Christmas is only 27 days after Thanksgiving. Fewer shopping days, fewer weekends. So the Saturday at the mall right before Christmas is likely to be really hellish. If you're able to do all your shopping online, I recommend that. It also means that there aren't really good times for Christmas parties. There's only one really good Saturday for having a Christmas party. It's December 14th. That's why all the Christmas parties are on December 14th. I liked it better last year when there were 33 days between Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunick, Jonathan Adler, and Jonathan Katz. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Jenna Cagle and Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. This is Cab's last show with us. Cab, I want to thank you very much and wish you the best. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.